Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
If you do raise your voice or shout or scream or you lose the plot, then you have literally lost control. And if you lose control, that's it, you're gone. Then he looked at me and he said, "Okay, how much do you want for your restaurant? I'll buy your restaurant, name your price." And I said, "No, you're not having this restaurant. It's not for sale. Stub out the cigar or off you go." And he stubbed out his cigar, gave me the ashtray and carried on eating. And he was back in his place. Le Gavroche was founded by my father and uncle. If I were to sell that, it would be like selling my right arm. It would be like selling my soul. No money in the world would be able to yank my arm off. Cook some dinner, rustle something up for Giselle. We can pop a cork on a nice bottle of wine and watch a movie on Netflix or, I don't know, EastEnders. I haven't watched EastEnders. But is it still on, by the way?
It is, apparently, yes. But you must be at least 30 years since you were able to catch it on a regular basis. Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest today is, well, hands down, one of the world's most celebrated chefs who comes from a culinary dynasty who've revolutionised the way we eat. Born in Kent in 1960 to French parents, the chef Albert Roux and his wife Monique, he literally spent his first day of life in the kitchen and, well, he's never left. He grew up on the wealthy country estate of the Cazalet family. They were horse trainers to the Queen Mother and his parents were their chefs. His love of food was evident from the get-go, preferring to play with dried pasta and flour rather than the conventional toys of childhood. When he was seven, his dad and Uncle Michel, who he's named after, pulled their savings, a grand total of £1,500 at the time, and decided to open their dream restaurant. They called it Le Gavroche. It was in London, and it fast became the restaurant by which all others were and are measured. On its opening night, it hosted Charlie Chaplin, Robert Redford and Ava Gardner. A few years later, it became the first restaurant in the UK to be awarded a Michelin star, and then another in quick succession, and eventually a third. By the time he was 16, the family business was flying, and he moved to Paris, crashing on his grandmother's sofa while studying an apprenticeship in pastry making. At 18, he landed a job as a chef at Alain Chapelle's three Michelin-starred restaurant near Lyon before being drafted for his French military service in order to retain his dual citizenship. But instead of training for battle, he was put to work in the most prestigious kitchen in France at the Élysée Palace, helping its army and dignitaries to march on a full stomach. But in the late 80s, he was summoned back to the UK to work at Le Gavroche by his father. And in 1991, he officially took over running the place. During his 35 years in charge, he's grown the family's legacy, which has seen some of the best chefs in the world come through their kitchens, be it Marco Pierre White, Pierre Kaufman, Marcus Waring or Gordon Ramsay. But whilst the restaurant's legacy and the Rue's legacy will live on, a few weeks ago, 56 years after its doors first opened, he made the decision, the difficult decision, to close the restaurant in search of a better work-life balance, wanting to be more present with his wife, his daughter Emily, and his two grandchildren. But this doesn't mean he's retiring just yet. He's keeping the name and taking it on tour and to the high seas, and is marking this new chapter with a book about home cooking, which is exactly where I would expect to find him today, although, turns out not so much. He's still at the restaurant he closed just 4 weeks ago. Let's dial him in. It's Michel Roux. How are you, sir?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for an extraordinary intro.
What an extraordinary life.
Well, it's not over yet as well.
Exactly. Thus far, I should have said, thus far. And do you know what? I thought, my goodness, we're going to get to see him at home today. But no, you're still in the restaurant that's closed. You're like the captain on his ship that the passengers have, you know, left. And it's just you there. You've just showed us around. It's ghostly.
It is, and it's quite emotional actually walking into here this in the mornings and to see the place. It is empty, save for a couple of staff that are here. They're helping me to box up the wines and to clean up the place. It's been a month now since the last service. Yeah, so it's taken us all that time to box up the wines, empty the cellars, clear everything, find stuff that we lost about 10 years ago. You know, like when you move house.
So annoying.
That's where it is. Kind of thing. There's been lots of those moments.
But it's 56 years in service. So, obviously not in that particular building, but between the two locations, 56 years. So you've never sat in that restaurant unless it's a national holiday where it hasn't been opened.
That's right. Other than the lockdown.
Of course.
And that was quite scary and very, very emotional. Tough, because that was the first time the business actually was forced to close. Very, very difficult. I was very close then to actually stopping and giving up.
Were you? Because I know your dad was also, with us then, and he too was losing sleep over what was going to become of not just your restaurant, but the industry as a whole. It was a time where I think any chef that cared really felt it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's something that we certainly don't want to go through again.
No.
And a lot of restaurants, a lot of people working in hospitality and businesses are still suffering from lockdown, still paying for it.
Yeah.
So it's very, very difficult. We wouldn't want to go through that again.
So clearly, I was expecting to find you, like I say, sat at your kitchen table, having, you know, pop something on some drama on ITV3 and living a semi-retired life. Not a bit of it. Here you are. It looks like you've been there every day as well, from what you're saying. So you clearly are. I was going to say, how is it cutting the cord? But I'm going to say you haven't quite got the scissors out yet.
Not quite. No. This morning, I had several meetings and I've literally just finished having a meeting with the accountant. Because there's a lot of financial tying of ends that needs to be done when you close a business. And closing a business in the right way. So looking after everybody, looking after the staff, looking after the way that we pay all our suppliers and the lease. So there's a lot to be done. And it's very important that I do it in the right way.
Yeah. Yeah, I fully respect that. How was your last service?
Oh, the last service was very, very emotional. So the last service, I had two last services. I had the last service of paying customers, And that was probably more difficult for the team, for the staff, than it was for me. But we kind of manipulated the bookings so that we only had really regular guests and people that we knew, and were almost not paying customers. They were more like friends and family. So there was a wonderful atmosphere. And then the actual last day was, more last evening, was just for me personally, very close family, close friends. And that was more emotional for me then.
I bet. What was more emotional, walking your daughter down the aisle and giving her away, or that night?
Ah, well, actually, now that is a story, because I didn't walk my daughter down the aisle.
Did you not?
No. She did, like myself and Giselle. She eloped.
Aha.
So there was nobody invited. I wasn't invited, which was a little bit, you know, I was a little bit peeved at that. But I couldn't get angry because I did the same thing.
Yeah,
saved me a lot of money
top
as well.
Thumping, going, this is outrageous. You've done exactly what we did.
It works for me and Giselle, so I'm pretty sure it's going to work for Emily and Jago.
And Emily and Jago, I should point out, also chefs, run a fantastic restaurant in Notting Hill. And I know that you discussed the possibility of, you know, was there an appetite from their end to step in at Le Gavroche? But they were already on their own path and said, no thanks, Dad.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that kind of informed your decision, right?
Yeah, it did, most certainly, because I had that conversation with Emily and Diego a while back, and they said to me, no, we don't want to do that. We want to do our own thing. We want to have our own restaurant and forge our own way in this, you know, in the hospitality world. And they're doing a great job and doing really well. So, yeah, no regrets.
No, absolutely. Well, you know, you obviously knew that the time was right. And you've timed it perfectly because you've got a new cookbook out, which is all about home cooking, which actually you're going to get to do now, because I can't imagine that there's many days then you're behind your own stove.
That's true. Although we're taking Le Gavroche on the road, as it were, and at sea, don't forget, because
yes, of course.
I'm going to be doing some work with the Queen Mary and the Queen Anne.
These aren't dead royals. These are boats.
Yes.
Yes. Trying to raise the dead, just entertain the seafarers. So what does that look like? Because, you know, you're designing what menus for them, but I'm guessing that they're going to want you on board as well at some point.
Mm. Yeah, I'm going to be on board about 30 days a year. Not only as a consultancy role and helping them train some chefs and all of that, but also running one of the restaurants when I'm going to be on board.
Nice. Which you're passionate about, right? You really believe that a chef should be seen in his kitchen and by the people that are dining at his restaurant, don't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I was one of the few chefs that was actually still in their kitchen and in their restaurant 9 days out of 10, for example. Guests would come here to Gavroche and they knew I was here. Most of the time I was here, and I would go out and greet everybody. And because for me, a restaurant is not just about the food, you know, it is hospitality. And hospitality means you have to look after your guests in a certain way. And me being the boss and the chef, then I had to go out and greet everyone.
It's that front of house touch that's so important.
Oh, it is. Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of chefs get it wrong. They think that, you know, their customers will come just solely for the food. No, that's not true. That's not true, because bad service can ruin your food.
All sorts of things inform the night. Even lighting, you know, the ambiance, the setting, yeah, the noise levels in the restaurant.
And the buzz and the atmosphere is created, obviously, by the guests, you know, enjoying themselves and laughter and all of that. But that comes also from the top. It comes from how the boss treats everybody, speaks to everybody. And by that, I mean not just the guests, but the front of house team and the kitchen. And so you speak to them in a certain way, and you make it in that they're enjoying what they're doing. And that rubs off onto your guests. And I always say as well that I can always tell a plate of food in front of me if it's been cooked by a happy or a grumpy chef. Now, by that, I mean, if a chef is, if it's a shouty kitchen, and if they're throwing plates around and shouting and screaming, then their food is never going to be as warm and loving and fulfilling as a chef with a, cooking with a smile on his face and having a nice controlled atmosphere in the kitchen where everybody is working together. So I'm pretty sure I can tell. You know, you can,
well, you've worked with both, right? They've come through your kitchens, both Marco Poi and Gordon, very shouty, but very much a product of the Roux family kitchen.
Yes, true. And both of them, I suppose, have got that that kind of fiery character that we've seen on television. But let's not forget that's entertainment as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amped, isn't it? Amped up.
Yeah, it is a bit.
Yeah. Although we've had Marcus Waring on, and he said even he used to be, you know, kind of guilty of losing it sometimes, you know, letting his temper get the better of him.
I put my hand up too. I think all chefs have occasionally lost their cool, and I put my hand up on me too. But I hate it because if you do raise your voice or shout or scream or you know, lose the plot, then you have literally lost control. And if you lose control, that's it. You're gone, aren't you?
You're pickled.
Yeah.
And not in
literally.
A good way. Now, I've devised three questions for you that I hope will afford us the opportunity to explore parts of your life and what a life it's been thus far. So can we dive into question number one? Obviously, a kitchen marches on the chant of yes, chef, but you are the chef that has become quite well known for saying no. And as in life with cooking, timing can often be everything. And you seem to have this ability to pull back and walk away when others would run at an opportunity. To close down something like Le Gavroche when so many people were probably dangling mighty carrots under your nose to keep either keep you going or to say, well, just sell it to us. We'll give you silly money. But you've said no to a lot of things that people would fall over themselves to say yes to. So where does that courage of conviction come from?
Gosh, where to start? I think it's... well, number one, I suppose I'm not materialistic. So if people start showing big wads of cash in front of me and saying, look, you can buy yourself a Ferrari, you can do this, that, and the other. No, I say, no, really? I've got all I want, really. I'm healthy. I've got two grandchildren. What else do I need in life? I've got a beautiful wife, and I'm happy. Okay? So is the addition of something else like a Ferrari or a mansion in the countryside going to make me feel happier? No, not really. But I've also got principles. And the principles will override anything else, because Le Gavroche was founded by my father and uncle. I've been at the helm 35 years, which was far longer than my father and uncle were. If I were to sell that, it would be like selling my right arm. It would be like selling my soul. I can't do that. There's no way. No money in the world would be able to, you know, yank my arm off. So it's precious. It's part of me. And it means so much to so many people that it would be wrong. Absolutely. It would be criminal to sell it on, and then a few years down the line, it would no longer be what all of these people enjoyed and have such wonderful memories about.
I think you're right about it meaning a lot to people. I think people that have never even eaten at Le Gavroche but just know of it were devastated when you shut the doors. People that would never have the opportunity to come and dine there for a multitude of reasons, be it financial, geographical, whatever. But people care about it because it was the spine from which a food revolution grew. And, you know, so many great chefs, yourself included, have come from that kind of the chutzpah that came out of two men coming together, two brothers, and saying, we've got 1,500 quid, let's go, you know.
Yeah.
Fly
yeah,
or die.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, it's part of the UK's gastronomic revolution and history in many ways.
Which is, when you look at the food scene now, French food really doesn't feature as a leading kind of cuisine. And yet, really, you guys were it. You started what became a food scene. With that, you know, when we wind back to when your uncle and your dad opened the restaurant, there wasn't really a restaurant scene, was there?
Very little. I mean, the food scene in the UK back in the 60s and 70s was practically non-existent. Mm. There were a few restaurants, independents, but very, very few. And then you had the restaurants in the hotels, which were really solely there for the very, very affluent. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, we had Dame Prulith on, and she was talking about when she got started. And she got started as a cook by doing kind of posh directors' lunches in the city because there were no restaurants for them to be hosted. So they would bring somebody in.
Yeah, that's 100% right.
Yeah.
Dad and uncle started an outside catering business in the 70s as well, doing just that, you know, providing food for the bankers in the city, in the old city of London.
So you knew that there was no way, no matter how big the check, no matter how many noughts, that Le Gavroche was for sale. Because Le Gavroche, spelt backwards or differently, or however you want to carve it up, is actually R-O-U-X. It's the Roux brand. It's the Roux family.
It is. Absolutely. I could be called Michel Gavroche rather than Michel Roux. It would be exactly that.
It would be the same.
Really, really, really odd for me, I suppose, but endearing in many ways. There's a family that came in to dine just before COVID, and they introduced me to their son. It was called Gavroche.
Ah.
Yeah. It's unreal, isn't it? It really is unreal.
And, you know, so many people will tell you in business, first rule of business, like, you know, lead with your head, not with your emotions. And you've done absolutely the opposite at every twist and turn with the way you've steered Le Gavroche. You've led with your heart and not by, you know, the end of year accounts. And I think there's something to be applauded in that, because it's drilled into us not to do that, and actually sometimes caring is invaluable.
I think it's part of the success story of Le Gavroche and the reason why it's been you know, around for so long, and it's I think what some people don't quite realize is that it still was a family run business, and small. It was not part of a big chain or not part of a restaurant group. It's just a standalone individual sort of independent business, and relatively small.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's no doubt that you could have rolled it out like an ivy. I can't imagine for one minute that would have sat well on your plate.
Absolutely no chance. There's no way I would have agreed to do that.
No. And because with the compromising of quality, the compromise of the brand, the fact that it would be money before integrity.
All of that. But also the fact that it would dilute all of those wonderful memories of people that have dined here over the last 50 odd years. You know, it's special. People fly, when I announced that I was closing, people flying in from all over the world, New Zealand, Australia, America, China, just to come and dine for a last time or a first time and last time at Le Gavroche.
Wow. There you go. From the heart. Not the pocket. Mm. I love that. The same, I think, could be said of your decision, which must have, like, I'm assuming you have an agent, right? And you certainly have a publisher. So when you walk away from big opportunities with your media work because you'd rather be in the kitchen. They must literally be headbutting their desks going, for God's sake, sell some books. I mean, I've asked you about your book three times and you just keep going back to talking about other stuff. I mean, you're a hopeless salesman, but a phenomenal chef.
You're absolutely right on that. They do get a little bit peeved with me and say, you should be doing more for this. You should be promoting your book more, or, you know, signing up for this program, that program. But if I were to say yes to every single opportunity on the television, I mean, I would, people would know me more for my TV work than they know me for my restaurants. And that's just wrong. I need a balance. So I needed a balance. And that balance was very much more focused on the restaurant and as a kind of side job, as it were, to do some media stuff and TV work.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite literally your amuse-bouche, wasn't it? It was never going to be a main course for you. And I think you must have really frustrated, for example, you know, organizations like the BBC, who, I mean, they have a very complicated editorial policy around so many things, and we won't even try and drill into making sense of that because it gets rewritten and reframed constantly, you know. But fundamentally, you left MasterChef The Professionals because they wanted you to give up a commercial partnership that was supporting a family-run business that supplied and had supplied you with potatoes for as long as you can remember at Le Gavroche. And you were like, no. Yeah. And they went, well, then you're going to have to leave. And you went, see you then, bye.
Yep.
love you, bye.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck?
Even more than that, because they still are, they're family friends. The Bartlett family.
These are the potato farmers, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And Ronnie Bartlett's dad was a friend of my dad, and we continued this partnership, and we're friends. Yes, there's a little bit of money that comes my way for being one of their brand ambassadors, but it's family, it's friends. And I certainly didn't want to break that that little bit of work that I do for them, but most importantly, that friendship. And so I basically said to the BBC, I'm sorry, I'm not going back on this. And too bad, and I'm walking off.
And you did, and you have.
Yeah, because, let's not go into Ed Pol, as they call it. At the very beginning, I thought, who is this guy, Ed Pol? And then I found out it was editorial policy.
But basically, you know, like whenever your computer updates and it goes, you have to agree the terms of the update. No. Basically, that's it. But the BBC version, nobody ever reads it. I feel so sorry for the people that have to write it, knowing that literally their work will never be looked at by anybody other than people that are working in their department and possibly agents lawyers.
It's designed for that. Absolutely. And to be honest, I should have done my homework and I should have read it, and I probably shouldn't have. Yeah, but there was a way out, and that way out was for me to back down, and I wasn't going to back down.
But don't you think there's so much power in not caring about walking away? And when I say not caring, what I mean is that you're prepared to, right? So that gives you such leverage in every situation, especially when your values and your value system is so juxtaposed to the people making you those offers. So most people think, well, if you throw enough money at him, he's going to say yes, right? And you just go, that is never going to tickle my, you know, fancy, I'm sorry. So do you then find people just sort of staring at you a bit weirdly, like, what is your motivation then? Because integrity has become so lost in our modern world.
Yes, and that whole sequence with the BBC was challenging my integrity, which is, that's why I moved on. But talking, just a little anecdote of many, many years ago, we're talking probably about 20 years ago. I remember now. The law had just changed, brought into no smoking in the restaurants. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's about 20 years ago. And busy evening service and a table of five or six. And they finished the main course, and one of the guests got a big fat cigar and lit up the cigar. So the manager went up to him, this gentleman, and said, "I'm sorry, sir, ashtray not allowed to smoke. Would you kindly put that out?" And he looked at him and went, "No, I want to smoke my cigar." So I said, "No, you're not allowed to. Please, this is disturbing the guests, and it's not actually not allowed. Don't care. Call me the owner." So manager came into the kitchen, came to see me, and he said, "Sorry, chef, but we've got a problem here." So I went to go and see him, presented the ashtray again, and said, "I'm sorry, you have to stub that out." Finished. And he looked around and he said, "Okay, I'm disturbing the guests. Go around and tell all your guests it's free tonight. I'll pay for them all." I looked at him and I said, "Nah, sorry. That's just not going to work. Cigar out. Finish." Then he looked at me and he said, "Okay, how much do you want for your restaurant? I'll buy your restaurant. Name your price." Yeah, yeah, I'm not joking.
How much had he drunk at this point?
They were still okay. They'd been drinking, but not that much.
Wow.
So, I mean, he still knew what he was talking about. But I gave him the ashtray again, and I said, "No, you're not having this restaurant. It's not for sale. Stub out the cigar, or off you go." And he stubbed out his cigar, gave me the ashtray, and carried on eating, and he was back in his place.
Wow. I mean, that's punchy.
Oh, yeah.
Him, not you.
I've never had any regrets, but it would have been nice to see how far he would have gone.
Just get a number on the back of a serviette, yeah? Like, go on then, what does it look like?
How many zeros?
And then to still say no at the end of it.
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
Are you ready for your second question? Le Gavroche is famed for its world-class teaching and training and the great chefs that we've already touched upon who have subsequently learned their craft there. And the ones that we've named are just the ones that have television profiles. There's countless others working in world-beating restaurants around the world. But I wondered, who have been your own greatest teachers? And not just in the kitchen, but in life. The people that have really, really informed who you are.
Wow. I would say I was very fortunate. I did a pastry apprenticeship in Paris at the age of 16. And he taught me life skills as well as being a pastry chef. And he taught me about respect and leadership. So he was the first one in the morning, the boss, last one out at night. No job was too menial. If the washer-up kitchen porter didn't come in one day, he would get in there, roll his sleeves up, and do some washing up. And very, very rarely did he raise his voice. But if he did, you knew you were in trouble. And it was also taught me never to be late, and just how to present yourself. So it was more than just, you know, the skills of being a pastry chef. It was life skills. And I think that's so important when you are that age and you start in an apprenticeship, to have a great mentor.
Yeah, because as much as your father and uncle mentored so many others, maybe you wouldn't have taken it so well from a relative. So you almost needed to go somewhere else to be just 100%. Like everyone else in the kitchen.
Yeah, 100%. And then outside of hospitality, not that I've ever worked with Sir Alex Ferguson, but I've always looked up to him. And I mean, I've met him several times. I've cooked for Sir Alex, and such a wonderful man. But he was someone, when he was in charge of Manchester United, that would take a decision, stand by it, even if it was a very, very hard decision to make. And for the most part, if there was something to be said about the players, he would do that in the dressing room, and it would stay in the dressing room. And he would always back up and not publicly say any bad about any of his team or players. And that is something which I always did hear. If I had something to say to one of the team members, I would take them apart, have a word. Not take them apart. Take them aside, I should say. Take them apart. No. Take them aside.
Butchering them.
And have a word. Yeah, have a word. Never, ever reprimand them in front of the others. It's just wrong. And so I looked at Sir Alex in many ways and really thought, this is the way that you have to gel a team to work together. And the way he got the best out of each individual, and I'm sure, and I know, some of them needed the famous hairdryer treatment, and others just needed a hug or a particular way to get the best out of them.
Yeah, he was quite an extraordinary leader. It certainly didn't work to anyone's formula but his own, did he? And am I right in thinking, you might know this better than I, as to whether or not this is true, but I believe that one of the things that he did with that sort of, it was the early 90s, he insisted that all of the kids in the academy at United learn how to cook.
Yes, that's true. I actually did a little bit of cooking with some of the team there as well.
Did you?
And I know that he was very, very keen on getting the executive head chefs and the team there to be cooking and sharing some recipes with the team. Yeah.
His fear was that they would leave the grounds and go and, you know, unaware of, you know, what life skills were needed to keep themselves going. He taught them how to look after themselves and, you know, how to do laundry and all that kind of stuff. But really important lessons on nutrition and the value of eating well.
Yeah, I think so. It's life skills. It's not too dissimilar from being an apprentice when I started. Yeah. It was life skills. It was learning respect, learning the, you know, not to be late, etc. Yeah, all of that.
It's interesting. I don't know if you've watched the Beckham documentary, but he touches very much on his relationship with him. And you could see at times he was a father figure. At other times he was a hairdryer. Yeah. But what he was always there. And the respect that David still holds for him, even though some of his decisions really hurt him ultimately, it speaks of his leadership, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, it does. So, a great man. And he's actually been in this room a couple of times, sat where I am here, enjoying some nice food and some jolly nice wine too.
Whilst you literally study everything he does so you can go and kind of replicate.
I've got his book up there, actually, on the bookshelf, signed copy.
So nice, though, when you can start to become close to somebody that you really admire and then not disappoint you.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
What about your daughter? Because I think being a parent teaches us so much, and often in hindsight, because at the time we're quite busy just like keeping them alive. But did you learn a lot about yourself and about life as a dad?
Yeah, I have little tinges of regret that I didn't spend enough time with her when she was a baby, a child, an infant. That I suppose is life in the hospitality industry. Long hours, especially in the high end world of, you know, Michelin star restaurants. Although she says no, you were there all the time, Dad, and this, that, and the other. But I still think I could have spent more time with her. One of the reasons why I've stopped running the restaurant and I can spend more time with my grandchildren.
Yeah, what's that like? Because you get all the love of a you know, somebody that's come from your DNA pool, but without any of the responsibility of getting them to bed every night. Just fill them with sugar and hand them back.
Oh God, yeah, that's great fun. But and you can spoil them rotten, God.
Totally. Yeah. None of the consequences are coming your way.
Emily does give me a hard time afterwards, saying, look what you've done to him. It is great, but I've forgotten how much energy a four-year-old has. Incredible.
But also, it's you just start to see the world through their eyes again. It simplifies life on so many levels, doesn't it?
It's beautiful, and having a conversation with a four-year-old, it's just wonderful, because they are so curious and they learn so much and so quickly, and they pick things up, and it's beautiful. I love it, absolutely love it.
What have you learned from your wife? Because you've had a long and very happy marriage, and she's had to put up with, you know, you working the crazy hours that you do. It's just something you've acknowledged many times over the years. But what has that relationship taught you, do you think?
Well, if it wasn't for Giselle, I probably wouldn't be talking to you now in a sane, hopefully it's a sane and comprehensible way. She keeps and still does, well, kept and still does keep my feet firmly on the ground, and reminded me over the years of where I came from. I didn't come, you know, from a very wealthy, high-end family or anything like that. Dad was a hard worker. Uncle was, and we have that in our DNA. We should never forget that. And to stay humble and normal, not big-headed. As soon as I started getting any kind of semblance of a big head, Giselle would say, "Oi,
yeah, that's enough now.
Come back down to earth.
Yeah, put it down."
Yeah, which is great. You know, it's. I think everybody needs that. I was going to say the hospitality industry, but it's everywhere. People do get big-headed, and maybe a big contract comes their way, or a bit of stroke of luck, or whatever. Well, they win the lottery, and then before you know it, they're, you know, big head, they forget respect, forget to be humble, and to forget their origins and where they came from.
Because actually, I mean, as much as you were born and raised for your early years on a very wealthy estate, it wasn't your family's estate. They were the chefs there. And as much as you catered to, the rich and famous, I think that people often then therefore assume that, well, you must also share those fabulous riches, your Michelin star restaurant. But actually, very few restaurateurs walk away with much in their pocket, because it's such a costly business. It's so high risk in so many ways, because you've no control how busy you are. I mean, Le Gavroche was always busy, but you know what I'm saying. Yeah, I think people would look at you and think, my God, you go to bed in cash. And actually, nah, pocket
no. No, I mean, I'm not complaining. You know, I'm a very wealthy person, but I feel that I have worked very, very hard for what I've got. But yeah, for sure, the hospitality industry is not easy. You don't get into the hospitality industry to become a millionaire, that's for sure. But you know, I was born, almost born on the estate, but our little country cottage where my mum and dad and myself were living was a one-bedroom little cottage. It was beautiful, but it certainly wasn't very affluent and large in any respect. And Dad used to grow vegetables and rear animals for the table. And we had a very, very frugal, very basic beginnings in the 60s and 70s. Mm. And then when we moved to London, the house we had in South London was a semi-detached and very suburban kind of ordinary, very ordinary. It was a two up, two down. So Dad never drove a Ferrari or anything silly like that. I mean, neither did I.
Yeah. And you still live not too far from where you were raised in South London, don't you?
Absolutely. I'm from South London and I get a nosebleed if I go further north.
Okay, my last question for you. As you step into what I'm sure you hope is a more relaxing, reflective, less pressured way of life, what do you look back on now as this kind of this, it's not the closing of a chapter, maybe it is the closing of a chapter, and think, gosh, I wish, what do you know now that you wish you'd known then that might have saved you some pain along the way?
Well, it definitely is a closing of a chapter. So closing of Le Gavroche here on 43 Upper Brook Street. But as I said earlier, we are taking it on the road. Closing of a chapter, but not the closing of the book.
The book. Yeah.
And I think that's important. What have I learned on this journey?
What do you know now that you'd wish you'd known so many years earlier that might have, I don't know, helped you play things differently, less painfully? I don't know.
It's difficult because I never dwell on mistakes or bad experiences. I try and push them to the back and move onward. I like to focus forward and on positives. I don't like, and I purposefully try and press the delete button and move on if something has gone wrong. And I think it's so important not to be afraid to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. I think at one stage of my life, I probably was afraid to make mistakes. And I think you have to embrace mistakes. And if you do, then you learn from them and you're stronger for it.
But then they're not mistakes, are they? They're lessons.
Indeed. Exactly that.
Yeah. Yeah. Although you did just say earlier that, you know, you look back on your time as a dad when your daughter was young and wish that you'd spent more time with her. So now you're trying to correct that. So actually there is a case in point of lessons learned, right? I'm not going to let that happen again because I'm regretful of that. So I'm going to be here for my grandchildren.
Yes, I suppose so. I suppose actually in the hospitality industry, we have to address long working hours, unsociable hours, working on Saturday and Sunday, and work conditions. And I think we have to a certain extent, but there's still more we could do. Sadly, there are still some dinosaurs out there that insist that their staff work ridiculous hours, and there's no positivity and no reason why it's not necessary. So I think we have to, as an industry, address that and change.
I can't imagine that you'd walk away from a conversation like that as well if you can roll up your sleeves and help. Even though you no longer are running a restaurant, I'm sure you'd like to have a say, stir the pot.
Yeah.
Yeah, too right. What does the next year look like for you? Because for the last 35 years, you've known what every year looks like. This one, slightly different. You know, your diary.
Yes. My diary is absolutely jam-packed. It's crazy. But not every night. So I've got nights where I can go home cook some dinner, rustle something up for Giselle. We can pop a cork on a nice bottle of wine and watch a movie on Netflix or, I don't know, EastEnders. I haven't watched EastEnders, but is it still on, by the way?
It is, apparently, yes. But you must be at least 30 years since you were able to catch it on a regular basis.
Well, you know what I mean.
Yeah. But,
yeah.
So, normality.
A little bit of normality, yeah.
Well, good luck with it. And thank you so much for sharing some of your fantastic stories with us today. The new chapter, can't wait to read it, quite literally. And I'm off now to cook my teenager your lemon butter garlic chicken, and it looks delicious.
Don't forget, you need a bit of bread to dunk into that, those lovely juices.
Good bread as well.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, Michelle Roux, a genuine kitchen legend. And if you want to cook like Michelle, don't forget his new book, At Home, is out now. So if that's left you smacking your lips, for more conversations with other great chefs and cooks, we've got fantastic episodes in our back catalogue with Dame Prue Leith, Rick Stein, James Martin, Marcus Waring, who trained at the in the Roux kitchen. Tom Kerridge is there, Lisa Faulkner, John Terode, the Hairy Bikers, and Faye Ripley. They're all waiting at the pass, waiting to be served to you. All you got to do is hit download. I'll be back on Tuesday with a special snack-sized episode from the White Wine Question Time cellar. Until then, thank you for listening.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.